Okay, everyone, thank you very much for being here today. I'm very pleased to be joined by my colleagues because this is a major announcement. The future of our country is incredibly important, and we need to have a plan for the economy, we need to have a plan for jobs, and we need to have a plan for cheaper electricity.
And with that statement, ladies and gentlemen, around mid-morning on Wednesday the 19th of June 2024, Peter Dutton broke the paralysis in our national energy debate. Hello, my name is Ben Beattie and welcome to the Baseload Podcast. Dutton's full press conference, including questions, lasted for about an hour, and I recommend everybody should have a listen to it. It's probably one of the most critical press conferences we've had on the energy system, maybe in the last 20 years, who knows, maybe ever. Perhaps Peter's picked up on my sentiment, where I'd rather look back in a decade and say, I helped fix it, than look back in three decades and say, I told you so. I recommend taking the time to listen to the announcement in its entirety. I think it's pretty important to see exactly what he said about it. Here's a few more words that came out of the intro to the press conference.
We've done an enormous amount of work. I want to pay tribute to Ted O'Brien. We've looked at the international experience. We've looked at why Australians are paying the highest electricity prices in the world. We've looked at the expert advice from the regulator, who's now telling us that under Labor's renewables-only policy, there is a greater likelihood of blackouts and brownouts. We know that the government has a renewables-only policy which is just not fit for purpose. No other country in the world can keep the lights on 24/7 with the renewables-only policy.
The thrashing and moaning by renewables advocates has been something to behold. Government ministers exposing their shallow thinking by creating a meme circus, which is funny in itself because we all know the left can't meme. A statement that's also a meme. Here's the Prime Minister speaking to Michael Rowland on the ABC this week.
Lighten up, Michael. For goodness sake, we're not going to take lectures from a mob who said that, you know, an advisory committee for Indigenous Australians on matters that affected them would lead to everyone losing their house and their private property.
Albo there comparing nuclear power to The Voice, which could be a self-defeating tactic since history shows over 60% of the country thought different to Albo. The opposite, in fact. Many polls, formal and informal, indicate that Australians are taking nuclear power seriously. Cameron Murray, an economist mostly interested in housing, and I recommend his most recent book, The Great Housing Hijack, that's on my bedside table at the moment. He had a poll on Twitter with some interesting questions. He said, I'm keen to understand how thinking about nuclear energy has changed in the past decade. I've changed from against to for nuclear. I'd be keen to get a feel from others whether they've changed their views, or if not, what their view is. Out of 1,340 votes, a relatively small impact, but Cameron's not a right-wing nut job like me by any means. So, you know, I assume he's got a range of people looking at his stuff. 24% are against nuclear power. 24% changed their minds and are now in favour of nuclear power. And over 50% have always been in favour of nuclear power. But it's not just Cameron Murray doing his informal polls on Twitter finding these results. These results are repeated in much larger and more formal polling. Here's Steve Kinnane on the ABC.
Polling from the Lowy Institute yesterday showed that 61% of Australians either somewhat or strongly support using nuclear power in Australia. Just 17% strongly oppose it.
One organisation you can be sure will never be in favour of nuclear power is the Australia Institute. Here's the uninspiring Ebony Bennett talking about stuff she knows nothing about.
The dumbest policy he'd ever seen a major party commit to. The most expensive form of new energy to build, according to the CSIRO, and tell about what will happen with the waste. The CSIRO has been very clear this is the most expensive form of new energy to build. I mean, this is a deeply unserious energy policy.
No media spot by the Australia Institute would be complete without repeating this.
Renewables are cheap. They're putting downwards pressure on electricity prices.
Perhaps it's not surprising that Ms. Bennett is uninformed. Here's Richard Marles, quizzed by Peter Stavanovic, who asked the right question, what's it all going to cost?
So what's the cost of the total renewables rollout?
Well, what we are... What we're seeing with renewables is, and this is the big difference today, Pete, compared to where we were at a decade or 15 years ago, is that the cheapest form of energy in the system is renewable energy.
Yeah, but what's the total cost?
Wholesale energy price. Well, the answer to the question around price is that we've seen a dramatic drop in the wholesale energy price as a result of seeing more renewables into the grid.
And but is it over a trillion? Is it over a trillion dollars?
You can pick out figures over particular periods of time.
But you don't know the total cost.
Well, what we know is that energy prices, wholesale energy prices are going down.
Perhaps the listeners picked the uncertainty there. I don't think anybody in government's ever been asked before what it's actually going to cost. If you're paying attention to the debate, there's plenty of people starting to ask that, including Peter Dutton.
We shall move to questions without notice and give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Prime Minister, what is the total cost of the government's energy plan and what will the capacity investment scheme cost taxpayers?
I cut the response short because you can see how it went.
Thanks very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, you've got to hand it to the Leader of the Opposition. At a time when the rest of us are working to get power bills down, he's picked the one option guaranteed to push power prices up.
Order.
Albo went on in this vein for some time, but he was asked again.
What is the total system cost of the government's energy plan and what will the capacity investment scheme cost taxpayers?
These are excellent and basic questions by the opposition leader. Ted O'Brien, the architect of the coalition's nuclear strategy, was, I don't know how you'd call it, heckled or something? I don't know what's going on in Parliament there, but here's Ted O'Brien trying to get his question out. Have a listen to what's going on.
Order. Members on my right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And my question goes to the Prime Minister. The Princeton University's Net Zero Australia report has modelled the capital cost of the energy transition according to a similar pathway to the government's current plan, with a cost of between $1.3 and $1.5 trillion. Prime Minister, what is the total system cost of the government's plan?
I wonder if that's representatives of the Smart Energy Council in the background there. The Prime Minister shouted a lot again, but failed to answer the question. Here's Ted asking the same question again.
Yes, point of order, Mr. Speaker, is relevance. The question was to the Prime Minister, what is the total system cost of the government's plan? This is going to be his third go at this one.
Of course, back in March 2024, Chris Bowen, the government's energy minister, was on the ABC Insiders and David Spears asked him what the cost would be.
Well, the best guide to the cost is AEMO's Integrated Systems Plan, which, if you like, looked at this in 2024 dollars, in current dollars, looked at the total cost out to 2050 of the entire generation, storage and transmission, and came up at $121 billion.
AEMO's 2024 final version of the Integrated System Plan was released this week, 1 week after Peter Dutton's nuclear announcement, and obviously to a great fanfare by the usual sycophants, shall we say. The $121 billion was largely repeated in AEMO's plan. They call it $122 billion now, and they call it a net present value of spending out to 2050. But let's have a quick discussion about what's missing from the costs. So, the ISP, this is reading from the ISP's fact sheet on the internet, and it says that the ISP factors in consumer resources. Consumer energy resources are appliances owned by homes or businesses, such as rooftop solar, home batteries, and electric vehicles. These appliances are a key part of the power system, and the Integrated System Plan takes these into account in working out what is needed to support the transition to net zero. While the role of these household appliances is considered in contributing to energy reliability and grid security, the costs are not modelled in the ISP, as these are purchases decided by households and businesses. What else does it say? The ISP does not include distribution costs. The ISP does not plan the distribution network, that is the poles and wires that connect individual households and businesses to the grid. Distribution system planning, including costs, happens at a state and local level, not in the ISP. The ISP does not plan for nuclear power. That's no real surprise. It's currently banned. But then they also say that GenCos finds nuclear generation to be a lot more expensive than other options. So when they say expensive, they don't mean things that they haven't modelled or costs that aren't included, do they? The very next paragraph. The ISP does not model the cost or benefits of infrastructure that was built in the past, is under construction, is committed to, or is anticipated to be developed. I wonder what all that could be. In addition, it does not include the costs of consumer energy resources such as rooftop solar home batteries and electric vehicles. You've got to admire the cojones on these guys to firstly say that they rely on home batteries, home solar panels, and electric vehicles because they're a critical part of the grid. And remember, these are all things that are meant to be coordinated with some kind of integrated vendor who manages these batteries on your behalf, not to your benefit, to the grid's benefit. So they rely on these things and they model these things and all these, this massive, around about 150 gigawatt hours of home batteries and EVs are meant to be part of the system, an integral part of the system. It's an integrated system plan after all. But despite the reliance of these devices in the modeling on the technical side, they don't include the costs. So what happens to the costs if hardly anybody buys a battery or they're not integrated, they're not coordinated? Jeff Russell is a data analyst with his own blog and he's active on the social media and quite often he makes some sense. In Jeff's blog, he's also talked about the batteries. He says, do the maths. 144 gigawatt hours of batteries at $1,455 per kilowatt hour is $209 billion. Of that, 88 gigawatt hours will be installed after 2040 for $128 billion. A detailed analysis would take a stab at guessing cost reductions, but $209 billion will still be a minimal estimate because GenCost, which you know the ISP relies on, also hides all the costs of household PV panels. In addition, I'm conservatively ignoring the costs of all of the batteries installed before 2030, which will need to be replaced by 2050. In summary, even without all the tedious details, two things are clear. Renewables are incredibly expensive, and we won't be finished with the buying of them by 2040, which some would argue would make nuclear redundant. Jeff continues. Now let's imagine he continues by linking the spending on these home batteries to the costs of nuclear, and that's exactly what the government is saying. The government is saying that nuclear costs too much. CSIRO is saying nuclear costs too much. AEMO's ISP is saying nuclear costs too much. And yet, they can only say that because they ignore the cost of these batteries. Jeff Russell continues, now let's imagine we take that $128 billion due to be spent on batteries after 2040 and invest it on nuclear energy now. At $8.5 billion per reactor, the supply chains could be sorted by 2040, and we could have 15 reactors rolling off them during the 2040s and go a long way towards setting Australia up for clean energy security through to 2100. With $200 billion, we'd get more than 23 reactors. Now, I have to say, Jeff, you're not going to win any friends in the bureaucracy or the government with factual, objective data like that. Prior to Dutton's nuclear announcement, Chris Bowen was on ABC Radio. Apart from struggling to pronounce the word nuclear, Mr. Bowen also struggles with some of the basic facts around the transition, or so they call it. Here he says it's absolutely necessary.
The issue about nuclear, Steve, is that it is a delaying tactic for the necessary renewable rollout in our country.
Okay, firstly, the word is spelt N-U-C-L-E-A-R. And pronounced nuclear. It's not spelt N-U-K-I-L-E-A-H and pronounced nuclear.
Nuclear.
But the real problem with Mr. Bowen's point there is that the transition, which is obviously some arbitrary target of renewables, 82%, pull that out of somewhere, that this is necessary. It is not necessary. The second problem I have with what Mr. Bowen said there was the point that
nuclear
power is a delaying tactic to keep coal-fired power stations online. Now, the coal-fired power stations are going to stay online no matter what, because guess what? Renewables, wind and solar, don't fill the gaps. You cannot turn wind and solar up to meet demand. It just doesn't happen that way. And this is exactly the problem that South Australia goes through every few days. And you can see that on the visualizations. The data shows that if they didn't have the gas or the diesel and the imports from Victoria, the lights would go out. Steve Kinnane's interview with Chris Bowen was an eye-opener for me because I wasn't expecting tough questions to be asked on the ABC. Here's a selection of the questions that Steve posed to our Energy Minister.
You want the next election to be a referendum on nuclear. There's a few other important issues kicking around, like the cost of living and the state of economy, aren't there? Is this going to be a scare campaign to rival Labor's Medi-Scare campaign of 2016? And what about the safety issue? Are you going to try and make out as if they're not safe? Is there a danger you might demonise nuclear power as an option? Because Australia may need small modular nuclear power. Can you get to your renewable target by 2030 when several projects are still years behind?
Mr. Bowen's responses to this line of questioning goes like this.
Well, Steve, I mean, let's keep this realistic. I've just run through the risks of moving to nuclear power. The risk is that it substantially delays the rollout of renewables, that it makes our energy system much less reliable because we're relying on fewer and fewer ageing coal-fired power stations. And that is the biggest risk to the reliability in the system.
I had this podcast ready to go just before Peter Dutton announced his nuclear policy on Wednesday last week, so I suffered some emotional damage from that because now I had to redo my whole intro. I've also been struggling with a broken laptop screen and school holidays and site work. So yeah, anyway, here's the previous edit.
We believed the climate wars were over.
Do you believe that human-induced climate change is dangerous?
What do you think of the tactics employed by someone like Stephen Nowakowski? Do you think Colin cares about the frogs and the owls and the birds?
Their opposition to renewables is accompanied by a scepticism of climate change.
So you don't accept the science of climate?
Are you providing cover for those who argue that no action is required on climate change?
From COVID conspiracies to climate change denialism and how offshore wind farms kill whales.
Shouldn't you disclose that you don't accept the science on climate change?
Hello, my name is Ben Beattie and welcome to the Baseload Podcast. Our opener was extracts from the ABC's Four Corners program titled Wind Wars, a 45-minute documentary intended to show that those who oppose the extensive industrialisation of the landscape with wind turbines are in reality climate deniers and conspiracy kooks. Or worse, fossil fuel shills.
Anti-wind farm campaigner who's been linked to the Warburg Foundation, which is an anti-wind farm lobby group with links to the fossil fuel industry.
It was founded by a long-term fossil fuel executive.
The ABC's Angus Grigg leaves the viewer with little doubt how he personally views the situation.
Wind power is essential to meet our green energy targets. It's free and clean. They provide a larger and more reliable energy source and will help get Australia the last mile to net zero by 2050.
At least he did give some insights into the incentives available to those prepared to host wind turbines on their land.
If it goes ahead, the Robinsons will receive almost $1 million a year in rent for the next 30 years.
Wind farms have been marvellous for us. Last year they paid our building and contents insurance, which came to about $11,000. We had another $3,000 grant, which paid for a new deep fryer.
It will provide a group of 22 landholders as much as $40,000 a year for each turbine on their land.
And along with the dramatic soundtrack, we get dire warnings about dark and mysterious forces at work, working against the renewables industry.
I think in many ways there are forces at work that are seeking to hinder the energy transition and are putting resources into doing that and aligning themselves with genuine community concerns, but also exaggerating them and also firing them with a level of misinformation which is very difficult to count.
But is it all that bad for the renewable sector? Just weeks ago, the federal budget was released. Here's Kane Thornton, chief spokesman for the renewables industry, gloating about the federal budget and the billions more subsidies for renewables.
That was a great budget for clean energy. In our nation's history, that was the single biggest federal government budget commitment to clean energy we've ever seen. This government has put clean energy front and centre of our economic future. And this budget will help to drive down power prices, create tens of thousands of jobs in clean energy across rural and regional Australia, and set us up to become a global clean energy superpower. What a fantastic budget that the Australian people should be incredibly proud of.
I guess it's an indicator of how successful the renewable sector has been, that this is still the only Australian podcast specific to energy that is pushing back against the narrative, and judging from lots of positive feedback I get, I seem to be hitting the right spot. There are a couple of other energy-specific podcasts around, but I think we all know they push in one direction only, and it's not with the best interest of the consumer at heart. I often wonder why more people don't ask questions, when the clear evidence from all our bills is that a high renewables grid must cost far more than what we have now, designed around baseload generation with a few peakers. That's the optimum model. I offer this opinion with explanation to plenty of people. Those who disagree cannot provide any convincing arguments in their defence. I often wonder if they have convinced themselves, or if they just stick their head in the sand and hope, or if they need more renewables in the grid either to validate their egos or as a source of income. Whatever the reason, the truth always wins in the end. I just hope the end of these insane policies and misinformation in the media is much closer than we think. There's been a lot happen in the energy space since the last episode of the Baseload podcast. It's difficult to know where to start. Let's throw some things out there. Peter Dutton's nuclear announcement, of course. Matt Keane quitting the LNP for a job in Alvo's climate change bureaucracy. Seems like a good fit, to be honest. Engineers Australia cancelling a nuclear presentation by Rob Parker after some criticism from Simon Holmes at court. Engineers Australia then caught lying about it. Four Corners, with a tepid attempt at balance on the debate about wind farms taking over the bush. Snowy 2's tunnel boring machine stuck again. Eraring Power Station extension conditions announced. We're yet to see if they're going to take the New South Wales government up on their offer. Ausgrid in New South Wales announcing solar export charges to plenty of noise from the solar industry. AEMO announced imminent gas shortages in Victoria. And we also, of course, our old favourite, GenCost. The 2024 version was released, initiating some ardent defence amid a storm of criticism, including notably from Aidan Morrison's CIS Energy Program through Freedom of Information requests. The heavily redacted results do more to confirm than alleviate suspicions. Aidan also released an in-depth paper detailing the massive federal government subsidies on the table for renewables. I hope they follow up with something detailing what comes out of the states as well. Another notable moment was CEO of Alinta Energy, one of the big ones in Australia. He had a press club address where he poured cold water on the hopes and dreams of those who think this transition is going to be a simple affair. And last but not least, the Integrated System Plan, 2024 version. It's out. And guess what? It says the same old thing. It's all fine, it's all cheap, and everything will be better. Just trust us. It's been a busy June. I've appeared on a couple of shows myself, including The Ex-Candidates with Stephen Tripp and Adam Zara. You can find that on Rumble. I spoke with Laura Jays on Sky News about GenCost and the transition, and also spoke with Alexandra Marshall on ADH TV and Chris Smith on TNT Radio. I'll be catching up with Damien Khoury this week on his ADH TV show The Other Side to talk about the nuclear proposal. And I have it on good authority that Vicky Campion may also have a show soon. Stay tuned for that. It would be amiss of me not to mention the handouts from both the federal and Queensland governments. $300 from Albo and $1,000 from Stephen Miles, the Queensland Premier. There must be an election coming up, huh? Both these handouts are for residential customers and will appear as credits in electricity bills. Here's Albo.
We had a decision over whether the energy price relief would go to people who were recipients of Commonwealth payments or everyone. They were the two options, essentially, because of the way it's designed. You weren't about to give everyone's tax data to the energy companies, and the audience here will be relieved that that's the case. So we had to make that decision. We made the decision of assisting every household because that's the most efficient way to do it, and that will have a moderating impact on inflation.
A little bit of wishful thinking there from Albo. You can hear it creeping in at the end. And here's Stephen Miles.
Price of everything is going up. whether that's the mortgage or the rent or groceries, the bills just keep going up. And I've been determined to make sure that the Queensland Government does absolutely everything we can to ease that pressure, to make it a little bit better. And so the DP and I have been working to identify every single dollar in our budget that can go towards those family bills, that can help Queensland families to put food on the table, to afford their rent and to keep paying the mortgage. And so today we're announcing that we've allocated $2.5 billion to provide to every single household $1,000 on their electricity bill. Vulnerable households will get even more, $1,372. That means that most households won't pay an electricity bill in the third quarter of this year, and those who use less than $1,000 a quarter will carry over a credit onto the fourth bill of the year. Many households won't pay an electricity bill until 2025. This is the biggest contribution a state has ever made to support households with their energy bills. We've also resolved, though, and as you know, I've foreshadowed for some time that the budget would include measures like this, but we've also decided that the cost of living crisis makes it too urgent to wait for the budget.
Miles seemed to be almost in tears there, but I'd suggest that he's more in danger of overacting and needing a second take to sound credible than of convincing anybody he's concerned about consumers. The politicians and the renewables lobby are too smart for the irony to have escaped them, that as a result of their policies, consumers need help paying their bills. St. Vincent de Paul's 2023 tariff tracking report, excellent output from Gavin Dufty's Social Policy Unit Victoria, says this. The base rates for electricity have increased in all states and territories compared to last year. In Victoria, electricity prices have increased by approximately 28%, in South Australia by 22%, in New South Wales and Queensland by 20%, in Tasmania by 10%, in the ACT by 4%, and in Western Australia and in the Northern Territory by 3%. From a longer-term perspective, compared to 2009, electricity prices have increased by 87% on average, with South Australia having experienced the greatest increase at 117%. To take a look at the effect of policies on small business electricity bills, we can refer to Energy Consumers Australia, Analysis of Small Business Retail Energy Bills in Australia, Final Report, December 2023. And they write, a jurisdictional comparison of small and medium enterprises consuming 20,000 kilowatt hours per annum shows that businesses in South Australia have the highest annual electricity bills, averaging $10,425, while Tasmanian businesses have the lowest average at $5,900. On average, nationally, annual electricity bills for small and medium enterprises with this consumption level increased by approximately $540 between October 2022 and October 2023. The greatest increases in annual electricity bills are in South Australia at $1,935, while the lowest increases in Western Australia. In July 2023, the Victorian default offer increased by 27% on average, and the default market offer increased by 19% in New South Wales, 23% in Queensland, and 29% in South Australia. And it's the policies that get us here. It is only better policies that can get us out. Like I said in my opening, I just hope it doesn't take too long. South Australia has seen very low wind output for most of May and June so far. There have been consecutive days of almost no wind, followed by consecutive days of high wind, then no wind again. This prompted me to post on Twitter a screenshot of the generator output for the 2 weeks, along with these comments. Imagine being an electricity retailer trying to contract your electricity supply around this mess in South Australia. Do you buy megawatt hours from gas, diesel, coal, solar, or wind? You're always very short or very long in something. Volatility increases error, therefore increases system cost. And then it happened again the following week. And I said, not again, surely, inevitable. Maybe there was a cheeky LOL in there somewhere. South Australia is a perfect example of what not to do. They're the canary in the coal mine for this transition. South Australia's annual electricity output from renewables is 70% of their supply, but they can only do this because they're connected to Victoria, which gives them the inertia and the backup through the interconnector. I had a bit more to say about South Australia when I discussed this with Laura Jays on Sky News last week.
Okay, final question. I think we're all talking about in this political debate at the moment, which is quite disturbing, is that, you know, we're talking kind of as if it's going to be 100% wind and solar, and then that'll be, you know, no one can really say what that last 10 or 20% is. And that, to me, spells that it would be very expensive and unreliable for the next couple of decades. Is that too cynical?
No, I think that's bang on. And the more people start talking about it, the better. We just have to look to the example of South Australia in the last couple of days. Mm. So there's, I described earlier, the wind drought that's occurring. So if we look to the data on South Australia, there's a period, it's I think 8:30 Sunday night, 1% of their electricity supply was from renewables. And that was a tiny little bit of wind and a bit of battery. The rest of their electricity came from Victoria, which is their coal plants running flat out. They could use a couple more, to be honest. Yep. Then you have gas and diesel filling in the rest. So this is the reality. So South Australia has quite a lot of renewables installed. I've described it in the past as 100% wind, 100% rooftop solar, and 100% gas and diesel as well, with a whole bunch of interconnectors and stuff. So they've got a lot of stuff there to supply not that many people, which is one of the reasons why their costs are so high.
And if I do say so myself, it's hard to argue with that.
A fucking goat, I'll say.
It's just a goat.
No, it's a fucking goat.
Yes, where would we be without the internet and with a handy phone camera to pick up gold nuggets like that? Also, where would we be without goat sound effects to make fun of people in podcasts? The goat this episode takes aim at the one and only Paul Graham, primary author of GenCost Report, who swears black and blue that renewables are the answer. Here he is talking to Patricia Karvelas on the ABC.
Paul Graham is the author of the CSIRO report and the chief economist at the CSIRO's energy business unit, and he joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Talk us through the main findings. What didn't we already know?
This is the first time we've actually included large-scale nuclear. In the past, we'd just been looking at what they call small modular reactors. And the reason we were looking at those is because they're of the size of sort of around 400 megawatts. And that's a more in keeping with the size of plant that we normally deploy in Australia.
Mr. Graham is being slightly disingenuous here. 400 megawatts is true, is probably the average unit size of a coal-fired power stations. But we haven't built one of those since the early 2000s. What I would suggest is that the average unit size of wind, judging by AEMO's generation information spreadsheet of deployed wind plants, is 103 megawatts. And the average size of a solar plant is 44 megawatts.
But we had the largest number of submissions we've had in a long time asking us to put in large-scale nuclear. And we thought it was worth looking at again. And we did decide that it is feasible to add into our system, at least in principle.
It's just a complete joke.
And those units are 1,000 to 1,400 megawatts. And we found that when we did some costings that it would be roughly 1.5 to 2.5 times the cost of firmed renewables.
Oh, really? I wonder what firmed renewables is and what it actually costs. Anyway, continue.
2.5 times.
Up to 2.5 times. That's also, I should say, only on the basis that we commit to a continuous building program. So, in fact, what we did realise when we looked at nuclear costs around the world is that they are at risk of what we call a first-of-a-kind premium. So when you build the first plant can cost up to 100% more. We found examples around the world where that had happened for nuclear.
Did the CSIRO, I wonder, bother to try and find a nuclear power station that had been built relatively cheaply? I wonder in this interview if they'll mention the Emirates.
We also know that's what's happened locally in Australia with projects like Snowy 2.0.
Objection, Your Honour, on grounds that this is redundant.
Of course, Snowy 2 is the infamous pumped hydro project that has its tunnel boring machine stuck again and has suffered cost and schedule blowouts. Unless someone's planning to build a nuclear power station underground, I don't understand the relevance.
So for the first time, you've looked at that at large-scale nuclear reactors rather than just the small modular ones. You said to me, I just want you to explain that if you can, because I find it really interesting. You said there were a lot of requests for you to do this. Where were they coming from?
Yes, when we updated the cost of small modular reactors in December, it was a very high cost. And what people realised was, well, that probably is the least commercially mature nuclear technology. What most people build around the world is, in fact, these large-scale reactors. And as I said, the reason we'd excluded them from the report in the past is because we don't really build generation units that size in Australia. They'll be almost double the size of the normal reactors we build in generation units we build in Australia.
Double the size of generation units we used to build in Australia. We need to acknowledge that Australia is going to need to build some new generation capacity at some point. But we have all energy pointed towards building small, intermittent, widely distributed, weather-dependent generators that can't meet the demand when we need it. While at the same time, we have bureaucracies, energy bureaucrats, and the commentators and the experts, quote mark experts, telling us that we're going to need a lot more electricity. So you're going to build small intermittent power stations to meet a higher electricity demand at the same time as you're closing down your biggest baseload generators. Can anybody not see the problem with that scenario? Can energy market expert Tony Wood see a problem with this scenario?
10 gigawatts of power in a system that's going to need 200 is reckoned very small indeed. The market operator forecasts that within the next 10 years, demand for electricity will double. So there are huge questions which so far the opposition and the shadow minister have been not prepared to answer as to what do we do in the next 10 years? What will be the role of different technologies? What will be the policy framework?
Firstly, doubling electricity demand is not forecast, it's a model, and is unlikely to happen, in my opinion. Secondly, if doubling electricity demand does occur, surely it's easier to meet that demand with big baseload power stations and not hundreds of small or thousands of small, widely distributed intermittent generators like wind and solar. Why is one party getting raked over the coals for proposing a sensible option, and the other party is getting a free pass on a crazy option?
But we did get our most number of submissions ever in the project 6 years, requesting us to include large-scale nuclear, so we were happy to take another look at it.
Of course you got a lot more submissions on GenCost because a lot more people are looking at it because a lot more people are concerned that it's all rubbish.
Now, the Coalition has criticised your research on the cost of nuclear reactors previously. Earlier this year, the CSIRO chief executive said politicians must resist the temptation to disparage science. What are you anticipating in relation to this report?
Look, our project's a bit unique in that we actually actively ask for criticism. This isn't a case where we just produce a report and say, here it is. We actually put out what we call a consultation draft, and we ask people to tell us what's wrong with our numbers, what do we need to fix. We don't expect to get everything right the first time. We really rely on the expertise of the energy community. And so if we come up with something that needs to be fixed, we'll fix it.
Scientists at the CSIRO are not engineers. Economists at the CSIRO don't know much about the energy system. And what's the point of GenCost in the first place? It's not like industry is using it.
But we do that on the basis of, you know, objectivity and evidence base that people would expect from CSIRO.
Didn't we just hear that there's been a hell of a lot more submissions on this one? And I suggest that many of them are highly critical of the report and its methodology. Is that what we expect from the CSIRO?
The report also details some of the costs for offshore wind, which the government is trying to develop. Your data shows it'll be really expensive. Why?
If you've got lots of land onshore, there's no doubt that onshore wind is lower cost. The reason that many countries consider offshore wind is because all of the onshore conflicts over land use can be avoided by going offshore. And then it does cost more, there's no doubt about that. Australia is kind of blessed. We still have a lot of onshore land. And so I think the main wind projects we'll see going ahead in Australia for the time being will be onshore. But there might be a time where when we've used up the best onshore wind sites when we will look to go offshore, probably later than other countries around the world, though.
It occurs to me that the phrase using up the best sites is very akin to a resources company looking for gold or coal or copper or you name it, whatever they're trying to get. Using up the best sites. I wonder what the greenies really think of that.
Nowakowski says he's not opposed to all renewables, but cannot accept the sheer scale of these wind farms.
You know, like, I think we're going down the wrong path in destroying forests to try to achieve an outcome which is decarbonisation. We can't destroy biodiversity to save the planet. And they're both hand in hand.
A key element of the renewable energy transition is the thousands of kilometres of transmission lines needed to connect the grid. Can you talk us through what that transmission cost is?
Yeah, it's on the order of another sort of $15 a megawatt hour.
From the GenCost report, we present variable renewable integration costs for 2023, which include committed and under construction pre-2030 storage and transmission projects. 2030 LCOE results are also included, but continue to exclude these pre-2030 costs, since by 2030 they will represent existing capacity. So listeners, you'll need to try and untangle that on your own, because I can't do it. Wouldn't it be easier for them just to list what's in and what's out? But they don't list what's in and what's out, do they? And why would that be?
It is essential for renewables because they're not located near the current load centres. You've got to go out to where the sun is shining more often and the wind is blowing. So you need to build that transmission out to places where the renewables are. And it also helps to have more transmission just to connect up the system so that if the wind's not blowing in New South Wales, it might be blowing in Queensland, and so you can share power across the landscape when it's available.
Is Paul Graham, lead energy economist at the CSIRO, suggesting that we build enough wind turbines in Queensland to supply New South Wales? Is that the logical endpoint of the argument the wind is always blowing somewhere? Does anybody see a problem with that? Is it reasonable to think that you will build enough wind power in Queensland to power Queensland and New South Wales? Is that what they think? And the transmission to move it? And the bloke sounds surprised when he gets lots of submissions and lots of criticism on his reports.
There's a big focus in the government's budget for the production of green hydrogen. You know, we've only got 30 seconds left, but how viable is that as an energy source?
This ought to be good.
It is the case that not every country around the world is as blessed as we are with energy. And so we think that some countries might need to import a green source of energy. One of those options is to import hydrogen. If it's generated from electricity, it's emission-free. And then some other country can import that and then have an emission-free energy source. We've got so much renewable energy, we will have enough to export.
10 gigawatts of power in a system that's going to need 200 is reckoned very small indeed. The market operator forecasts that within the next 10 years, demand for electricity will double.
You've been listening to the Baseload podcast. If you like the show, subscribe and tell your friends. Remember, the mailbox is open, thebaseloadpodcast@gmail.com.